Being past the hour of 4:30, I'm going to call this meeting of the Local Government Committee to order. Now we have a quorum, so. Representative Kalin moves House File 2954 to be recommended to pass.
Is this the Dill bill?
This is the Representative Dill's bill. 2954 to be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. And with that, I believe there's only a small portion of this bill that pertains to local government. So, Representative Dill, if you want to explain your bill.
I assume, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Chair Nelson, are you referring to Section 1 you must be referring to? That is a local government section of the bill, as I understand it.
That's my understanding, too. And if you
thank you.
Your testimony of that, we can get on the way.
All right. Well, there's about 22 to 25 counties down in southern Minnesota and southwestern Minnesota and up along the South Dakota border that have less than 3% of their acreage as forested lands. And the new language in this bill that by and large starts on, let's look at page 2 of the bill, section C, which is line 2.5 on page 2, allows for the county commissioners to, in an area that's not prescribed under 88.01 subdivision 6, where wildfires would be, generally speaking, a problem, allows them, considering the history and the distribution of trees, brush, and grassland, vegetative materials, to develop a burning plan in coordination with the Commissioner of Natural Resources. And upon approval by the county board and upon approval of the plan, would allow for a general burning permit to be issued, and that the county would then allow stakeholders or landowners, as a rule, to do burning without having a permit under the existing permit system, which right now is either electronic or paper. And that's really the gist of this language. At any time the commissioner or the board determine that the general burning permit is no longer in the public interest, it could be canceled by mutual agreement of the county board. With that, I'd stand for questions. It's enabling. At no time will the burning restrictions of a permit, a general permit, be less restrictive than the state's existing laws that we have today. It's just how do we get the people the ability to actually do the burning is what this really does.
Okay. Any questions of the Representative Dill? Are there anybody here that would like to speak for or against the bill? If not, Representative Kalin renews his motion that House File 2954 be recommended to pass to be returned to the State and Local Government Committee. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Bill is passed. Next bill on the session is House File 3065. Representative Simon. And Representative Sterner moves that House File 3065 be recommended to pass and to be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government. And with that, Representative Simon, if you please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First, a question to you, Mr. Chair. I have a small amendment. Would you like me to put that on now, or would you like me to wait?
That would, yes. When we put the amendment on now, Representative, is that the A1 amendment?
It is the A1 amendment, but I'm afraid that I'm going to have to amend that amendment. I don't know how you would like
me to
handle it.
Why don't you incorporate, you put your amendment, and we'll just incorporate it in the A1 amendment.
Sure.
You have it written down so that
pardon me. I thought I had a copy of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 1.2 of the amendment, strike the word bank and change the letter A, as in the word A, to an. So it would read an office located instead of a bank office located.
And do you have that So it's just, so it should read, it should can't even talk here. Insert colon N office located colon or semicolon. But that's what should read, an office located.
Mr. Chair, no colons. I think that just the quoted language would
quoted,
be
or quote,
an
yeah,
office
sorry,
located.
Quote,
end quote.
Wrong. I'm not an English major.
Mr. Chair, you have two lifelines left.
Okay. So Representative Sterner moves the amendment as it was the language change incorporated in it. All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Go ahead and explain your bill then, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill pertains to Chapter 118A, which governs the deposit and investment of municipal funds, and there are two much-needed reforms in here. And to explain the details, I'd like to hand it over to a couple testifiers, the first of which is Mr. Grunhofer from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Please welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Grunhofer, General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities. And we're here to speak in support of House File 3065. And we'd like to thank Representative Simon for advocating this piece of legislation on our behalf. Really, two separate things we're trying to do here. Section 1 and Section 2, the basic thrust of both amendments is to try to save cities some money and provide them some additional options for some of their investment decisions. Section 1 of the bill expands the group of financial institutions that local governments, cities, counties, schools, can use for purposes of doing securities lending. Presently, the law states that a local government may do securities lending with a financial institution with its principal executive office located in the Minnesota in the state of Minnesota. What has happened over the last several years with the result of mergers and that sort of thing is that essentially we only have one bank in Minnesota that is eligible to do securities lending for local governments, because only U.S. Bank has its principal executive office located in Minnesota. For instance, even Wells Fargo does not have its principal executive office here in Minnesota. We think local governments need to have some additional investment options there. As much as we love Minnesota businesses and we love to do business with Minnesota businesses, having only one option for securities lending we don't think is particularly good practice. And again, nothing against U.S. Bank. The League of Cities uses them for its custodian services and elsewise, but we just think public policy would suggest providing some additional investment options. Section 2 of the bill makes some similar modifications to the list of entities that can actually hold securities for local governments. We call that safekeeping. There's folks that will do the investing, and then there's other entities that will hold the securities. Presently, a number of our investment firms that do investments for local governments then have to go and transfer the actual investments to another entity to do the safekeeping. We'd like this amendment in Section 2 to be adopted so that those investment firms can actually do the safekeeping so long as they have the required insurance in place as talked about in the bill. And got a couple other testifiers who will speak specifically to the items in Section 2. I would stand for any questions if there are any.
Any questions of the testifier? Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. My question would be, is security brokers dealers, are there any security brokers dealers having their bank or their location in the state of Minnesota? And then also, are there any other community banks that would qualify to be able to do these services other than the major Fortune 500 style banks?
Mr. Chair, Member Stearns, yes, there are other banks in Minnesota that qualify as safekeepers, and including Wells Fargo. I think there might be some others. I don't know for sure. In terms of securities broker-dealers, even the Minnesota securities broker-dealers wouldn't qualify as safe keepers under the way the law currently is written, because they don't have the insurance typically to cover that.
All right, thank you.
I could be, Stan, corrected by certain experts in the audience.
Representative Sterner?
I'm fine. Yep, thank you.
Any other questions of the testifier? You have another?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have two more people who want to weigh in on this, I believe.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Kenny. I'm with the State Auditor's Office. And the State Auditor supports the second section of the bill. We don't have any opinion or position on the first part of it. There's two reasons that we support the change in safekeepers for public investments. Number one, the current situation makes it very, very difficult for public entities to comply. There are very, very few brokers that actually have a principal executive office in the state. This bill was, the original statutory language was passed, sometime in the past, and it may have been to give some preference to Piper Jaffray or Dane Bosworth, but neither of those two brokerage firms exist in that form today. Quite a number of entities are out of compliance with the statute, local governments, counties, and cities, because they've been doing business with a broker and they were unaware that they had to transfer it to a bank with a trust department. And so by passing this legislation, we'll save a lot of public entities the costs of buying through a broker and then transferring it over to a bank with a trust department. And again, because there's so few brokers that qualify to purchase and hold the securities. The second reason the auditor supports this bill is that having a principal executive office in the state on behalf of a broker doesn't increase the security or help make the holding of the securities any safer. But the new amendatory language requires that the broker have insurance to protect public funds, and this will provide protection to public entities that have a broker purchase and hold their securities. So by adopting this change, you'll help many counties and cities avoid the separate costs of paying a bank to safekeep their securities. You'll bring them into compliance with the statute, and you'll provide additional security to them because their broker will be required to have SIPC coverage to hold their securities. And I would be glad to answer any questions. I know there's someone else ready to testify as well.
Anybody have any questions for this testifier? If not, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one more testifier who has traveled a bit to get here.
Thank you, sir. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Steve Rolick. I'm the treasurer of Steele County, Minnesota, and I am in support also of the second section, as Dave Kenny talked about. We are in support of, or I am in support of, Dave Kenny and the state auditor's position on the section two because of the no primary or no local home office security brokers are in Minnesota anymore. So we are in support of that section, and I think it will make it much easier for municipal treasurers and across the state to comply with the state statutes.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for the testifier? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to speak for or against the bill? If not, Representative Simon, do you want to wrap up and closing statement?
Thank you, members, for your time. I know you've got a busy agenda. I urge your support.
Okay, all those in favor of the House file, well, first, Representative Sterner renews his motion to move House File 3065 to be recommended to pass as amended and to return to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All those in favor of the bill, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Next bill on the file is Representative Dabney here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
House File 3292, and Representative Hornstein moves House File 3292 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on Local, State and Local Government. Welcome to the committee, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. Good afternoon. House File 3292 would allow Hennepin County to construct a wind turbine in western Hennepin County to produce and sell the power generated by that facility. Permission has already been secured from the city of Medina, where the turbine would be built. This legislation aligns well with the state's seabed policy. It is similar to permission previously granted to the EDA of Mountain Iron, the county of Winona, and every school district in the state. In members' packet is a letter, I believe, from Commissioner McLaughlin of Hennepin County, who not only chairs the Public Works, Energy, and Environment Committee and co-chair of the Intergovernment Relations Committee for Hennepin County, but also has been a national leader at linking counties up with alternative energy development. And you can, members can review that letter at their own. With me today is Mr. Carl Michaud, who's the director of Hennepin County's Department of Environmental Services and can speak to the particulars of the proposal.
Thank you. Lisa, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Carl Michaud. I'm director of Environmental Services for Hennepin County. And I'm very pleased to be here today and am very supportive of this legislation that would allow Hennepin County to create this limited liability partnership or a limited liability company or a shareholder in a corporation for the purposes of building a wind turbine in the city of Medina. We're seeking this legislation because it would give us additional financial incentives here for this renewable energy project. And this is certainly similar to the benefits that a private owner or developer would get for a renewable energy project. And as Representative Dabney has already mentioned, you've already given this authority to the city of Mountain Iron, all the school districts, and the county of Winona. And we're seeking this change or this legislation specifically to develop that turbine in the city of Medina. This is part of our overall package in the county to develop some of our own energy for our own use, and it meets a lot of the policy goals for the state and certainly would be something that would make the project or contribute to making the project more financially, economically viable. So thank you.
Is there any questions for the testifier or for the author? Representative Beard.
Maybe not a question just so much, Mr. Chair, as an observation. And I brought this up a couple years ago when we did it for the school districts. And I wasn't aware of the other two. They've slipped through here somewhere, I'm sure. But, you know, school districts are in the business of teaching our kids. We don't want them in the business of running a delicatessen or a butcher shop, necessarily. And I'm certainly wondering why in the world we let them get into the energy business. Members, we act as if, and you can take a nap. You've heard this before, members, but I just have to get it off my chest. We act as if there is no downside risk in any of these business adventures, as if it's all we're doing is printing money here. And frankly, as long as there are huge federal incentives, it is kind of like printing money because they're printing it and sending it out here to make sure we have an upside, enough of an upside to overcome the natural non-competitive nature of the energy source we're dealing with. In this particular case, it's a windmill. I will speak against anything like this and vote no. Nothing personal, but just on principle. The government should be about the business of governing, which does things like plow the streets and run the jails and the courthouses and the things they're supposed to do. And we leave making things, whether it's hot dogs or electricity, to the people who are really good at doing that. Yes, we've done it for some other folks. The municipal power company that my city owns, through a 100-year-old agreement with the citizens of its jurisdiction, has one of the 9 windmills that we paid $300,000 for. That was the taxpayers that paid for that, by the way. And there it sits. Hasn't turned a blade since it went up last fall. It will be shortly. But, again, members, we act like there's no downside on these things. There's no risk to be spread to the taxpayers. And if it was a good idea, there'd be somebody doing it, which leads me to my last concluding remark, Mr. Chairman. If you really like clean energy that makes common sense, There's something called the Crown Hydro Project right on the banks of the Mississippi in downtown Minneapolis that will put between 3 and 4 megawatts of clean, quiet, green, bring myself to say that word, common sense power right into the grid in the heart of downtown Minneapolis with no new transmission lines. Oh, by the way, the infrastructure can already handle the power. Representative Dabney, I know you're a Minneapolis legislator. I would welcome your support in helping get that thing out of the Minneapolis Park Board and onto the grid so we're actually doing common sense things that somebody else put up the money for and that your ratepayers can pay a low rate for. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and prepare to vote.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Representative Kalin, you have a question?
No.
Sorry, I was misinformed.
Mr. Chair, I just think it was a remarkable moment that Representative Beard mentioned the word green in a positive light. And I think we should mark that it's about 5 o'clock.
Any other questions for the testifier or for the author of the bill?
Mr. Chair?
Representative?
If Representative Beard would like, he can become a co-author on my legislation extending the sales tax exemption on construction materials for the hydro plant being constructed on the Mississippi River in downtown Minneapolis right off of the 35W bridge. I'd appreciate the support.
Outstanding. You've got it.
And Mr. Chair, or Mr. Representative Dabney, that's an issue that's near and dear to my heart, too, seeing as how my father-in-law worked there for 25 years at that plant, so that used to power the streetcar lines originally for the city of Minneapolis.
Amazing history.
So, anyway, with that, Representative Hornstein renews his motion that House File 3292 be passed and be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill's passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The next one, bill on the agenda for today is House File 2786, Representative Reinertz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, you should
One second. I got Representative Hilty moves that House File 2786 be recommended to pass and to be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government. And with that, Representative Reiner, you can explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is also an A1 amendment, if we could put that on just to start with.
Representative Hilty moves.
I'll move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment to put the bill in the author, the shape the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House File 2786 is a bill that would enable the Spirit Mountain Recreation Authority, which is in my district in Duluth, to expand its board from 7 to 9 members. That board number is specified in statute. Members arrive on the board via an appointment by the mayor. They are also sort of blessed by the Parks and Rec Board, and then they are approved by the city council. But as an authority, the specified number starts here with the legislature. Back in 2008, Spirit Mountain adopted a new master plan, and there's a couple things that are significant about that. First of all, it's the first complete revision of the master plan since the area was opened in the early 70s. And secondly, it received a unanimous positive vote from the Duluth City Council, which, having served on that body for 6 years, I can tell you, committee members, does not happen very often. So it was nice to get that done. The primary emphasis of this new master plan was to make it a four-season facility. I think we all have stories at home of local government, local folks that are doing great things, given the challenges we have both in terms of state funding and the economy. The new executive director at Spirit Mountain, a woman by the name of Renee Mattson, has been doing some fabulous things at Spirit Mountain, and one of those is an effort to make it a four-season facility, and so it has multiple revenue streams instead of just skiing. What they have found is with the new master plan and with these new endeavors, it's brought a lot of work. And what they would like to do is add 2 more members to the board so that they can share that workload. And it has my support. One of the things that I also am hopeful is that the board is pretty representative of a lot of diverse stakeholders in the community, but one group that is not included currently is the Native American community. Spirit Mountain has a
history with, a sacred history with the native peoples of the Anishinaabe tribes. And I have encouraged them to make that request, and I know Mayor Ness in Duluth is also looking to make that appointment as well. So this bill has moved forward in the Senate. It's passed its first committee, and I'm hopeful that it can pass this committee as well.
Thank you, Representative Reinert. Are there any questions of the representative? Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Reinert, I'm just wondering, do these board members make any income or at all? It's all volunteer board?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sterner, it's an all-volunteer board. There's not even a per diem or a stipend.
Thank you.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Reinert, are there members of both genders currently serving on the board?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin, there are. I've not been to a board meeting in this calendar year, but as of last year, it was just like there. I think there was one more man than woman. I mean, it's a pretty evenly distributed board.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Reinert, I think there's a real urgency for this bill to be adopted, given the changes on lines 21 to 23 and page 1. So I hope that we do approve the bill with speed. But I have one procedural question. I noticed that we're amending laws 1973, that this is not in statute. So will the authorizing language, Ms. Dyson, I think this is a question for you, will the authorizing language remain in laws 73 as well as show up in session law 2010?
Oh, Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kalin, the sections that are amended this year will show up in the session laws as 2010 amendments to the provisions, and as you'll see, it already reflects that it was Law 73, Chapter 327, Section 2, Subdivision 2, as amended by 1979. There are other provisions of the special law for the Spirit Mountain enabling legislation that have three or four levels of amendments over the years, but it is never codified. This is special law for Spirit Mountain and the City of Duluth, so it always remains in session law, but when we pull up a section, all prior amendments are show up as engrossed into it, and you'd like to look at the prior ones. I have them all here. But it will not be codified. It's special law, but it will be in the session law, the brown books. Yes.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, I mean, it's partly out of curiosity, but partly also when we dealt with this with the it was a special law, and I think also in 73 that allocated the responsibility for municipal misdemeanors be prosecuted by our county attorney in Chisago, and it's chasing down the history of it has been interesting. I'm not one to keep on adding to the code, but I'm just wanted to sort of raise that as a point that at some point it becomes kind of Byzantine to follow session laws and makes it inaccessible in some ways to the public.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, that has always been a problem, finding laws, and frequently we tell local governments you're responsible to know what laws apply to you because they come in and ask for special laws. But I will also say that the revisers extend system, as of 2008, they have loaded into the system a searchable database so that you can plug in the name of a community and search all session laws back to the founding of the state. And it will bring up every session law with the terms you're searching for back then. So the ability to find special laws relating to local governments is extraordinarily improved very recently. So,
Mr. Chair.
Question to the bill?
Just a point to you as chair, when you make the division report in the parent committee, it may actually be something that I know the Chair Pulaski. If he doesn't know already, I think the committee may be interested in knowing that and making sure the public knows of that tool. Because I've been working with the revisor's office on other technology pieces. I think that's a good point, and I think I appreciate Representative Reinert giving us the opportunity to learn that.
Representative Eastland, you have a question.
Yeah, maybe this is a
to the bill.
An ignorant question, or a question that reveals ignorance, I should say. The question is there. But why is it that this has to be defined in statute or in session law? Well, I mean,
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, local governments have the authority that's given to them by the legislature. It's not a matter of taking away authority. It's a matter of granting authority.
Okay, and I this is probably a fine piece of legislation. I don't know. It's just I just look at it, and in my experience, as the size of directing or directors, the number of directors on any boards get larger, the whole management of issues oftentimes get more complex. You know, and you know, I mean, I'm sure the city of Duluth has a, I don't know how big their city council is. You know, I probably isn't seven, or I don't know, but I guess I'm having a hard time understanding the amount of work that goes into this group, and that seems to be the biggest. We've got to share the workload. I don't understand that. The other thing is the equity. You know, bringing in different groups that are represented. I mean, it could be done with seven. Also, if that was an important thing, I think it could be done. So I guess I'm kind of neutral on this. I'm just trying to understand how going to nine is really going to accomplish anything more than they could do now, other than what you've already said. It seems to me that it gets more cumbersome to work with a bigger group. But that's just kind of my response.
Representative Reinert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, the council has nine, actually, so same size body. But the primary driving factor is the workload. As I've indicated, with the diversification of the activities at Spirit Mountain and a working board, they're not a board that just shows up and adds a few comments and then you don't see them again for another month. They actually are very involved with the different activities and events at the facility, and as you add three more seasons, that workload has increased. And, you know, frankly, that contribution by nine volunteers is what's helped make Spirit Mountain a going venture under their new executive director. I mean, in the first 4 years of my term on the council, Spirit Mountain was a struggle. It got a significant chunk of tourism tax allocation from the city, and in the last 3 years under this new executive director, with a revived board that's doing a lot of work, it's become a very going concern, and that's been nice to see in a time of struggles elsewhere. So,
Representative Eastland, any more questions for the representative? Anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? If not, Representative Hilty renews his motion that House File 2786 be returned or be passed and returned to the Committee on State and Local Government as amended. Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I almost said that at the beginning. I had to think about it. Moving right along here, Dave. Okay. Next bill is House File 2949. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. See, before we get started, the Council does have a PowerPoint. I don't know if with the timing, with deadlines and so on, if that's something you want to entertain, or we're just wondering whether we should hook it up or not.
How long?
14 slides.
14 slides. Okay, would we have somebody? Okay. Yeah. While he's doing that, why don't we get it set up? But I'll start with Representative Sterner moves that House File 2949 be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government. And you have an amendment, I believe?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. I have the H2949 DE1 amendment.
Representative Sterner moves the DE1 amendment.
Representative
Sterner. Put the bill in the order that the author would like. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I can just give a few words of introduction as we get ramped up here.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
I do have Mr. Willett from Metro or Met Council, but the bill deals with the issue of the sewer availability charge, or the SAC charge that goes for new development, and that is what helps support the reserve funds for the Met Council for their wastewater treatment system, as opposed to funds that go to operating from the regular sewer bill that you have. Because of slowing growth in the metro area, the amount of money coming in from the sewer availability charge, or the SAC, is reduced, and so those reserve capacity funds are dangerously low. This bill would ask that we would be able to use money from that's collected from your regular sewer bill to really cover that until such time as the SAC charge funding can go up. And I was happy to say that one reason we didn't go a week ago is because Metro Cities and the Met Council were working out this amendment to make sure that the money went back the other way and the way it was intended once things turn around. And I will hand it over to Mr. Willett.
You can work out.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jason Willett.
Okay.
I'm finance director for MCS. That's the wastewater division of the Metropolitan Council. As you know, the wastewater division is funded entirely by fees. And shortly, I'll have a slide to show you what that looks like. We serve 105 cities in the metropolitan area directly and some others indirectly. Sorry. We have 7 treatment plants, hundreds of miles of pipes. There are no state dollars involved in any of this. There are no property taxes, just so you know. What we do need, as Representative Gardner mentioned, is a little flexibility to temporarily shift between our fee sources. Okay. Here's the slide that shows you 100% of the fees for our wastewater system. The municipal wastewater charge is sort of a wholesale fee that we charge the 105 cities, and overwhelmingly that's where most of the money comes from. The SAC fee that you can see here is 14% is the fee that we charge essentially to new development that requires availability or capacity in the system. That's the one, as you might imagine, is suffering, and I'll talk some more about that. The industrial specific charges we charge directly to about 800 industries that we serve for the extra cost that we incur supporting their services. The SAC fees funds kind of go like this. If and when there's development in the communities, and this is residential, commercial, industrial, institutional, the cities charge a local SAC fee, and the money from that comes into their city funds, and then we charge them a metropolitan SAC, and that they have to report to us generally monthly. That goes into this reserve capacity fund. The SAC transfer that's shown on the bottom of this slide is really what's governed by state statute and requires that we make transfer towards the general operation of the wastewater utility every year. So the statute is shown on the bottom of this slide, 473.517. That's what we're seeking to amend. That requires that we use these funds to pay a portion of our capital costs or debt service costs. This is perhaps a poor illustration. It's supposed to be a pipe showing you the used portion where there would be wastewater flow in the bottom, the reserve portion that's built for future users in the top. Typically, over the last several years, that reserve portion has varied from 25% to 40%. So we would pay 25% to 40% of our debt service or capital costs from the SAC fee. About 1.5% also goes to the administration cost of the program. Here you can see the problem. This fee has been in place since 1973. Typically, over the long-term average, we've got about 20,000 units collected. Both of the last 2 years were record low. We have not seen anything like this. There really is very little development in the entire sewered area of the metropolitan area. And the result of that is that this reserve capacity fund that we keep to make this required transfer has dropped precipitously. We had to use $17 million out of this reserve fund in 08 to meet the transfer, $23 million in 09. Depending on what happens, of course, with development, we could actually run out of money in it next year and the year after. The estimates that we've heard from economists really are not predicting a quick recovery in development. For instance, in the commercial area, there's 15% to 20% vacancy factor right now. So even when the economy looks like it recovers, for a while there won't be a whole lot of new building of that type of space, because there's available space that can be rented or bought. The only option we have under the statute as it sits today is to raise the rate of the basic SAC rate, and we've done that aggressively in the last few years. This has exceeded the rate increase of our regular sewer charge quite a bit. However, the sharp increases that would be necessary if this recession continues could actually slow the recovery or push whatever growth there is outside the sewer area. If you can remember basic math, as the number of units we collect here moves towards zero, we have to divide by zero, and the rate that we have to charge moves towards infinity. It could be really quite bad. So the legislative request actually is just about flexibility. The SAC rates and fund, when they are not sufficient to fund that reserve capacity, in the view of the Metropolitan Council, after appropriate study and with a public hearing, then we would want to be able to shift between those two funds. Now, this is one of the things that we've been negotiating with Metro Cities. This trigger has been tightened up a little bit. It's in Section B of the language that's added. That section requires that the reserve fund falls below 1 year of the normal transfer amount. There's also a Section C that was added as a result of the discussion with Metro Cities. And what that says is, when times return to normal, we'll shift back so that this equity between the current and future users is returned to normal. And we, I think Patty Nauman from Metro Cities is here and will speak in the end that we have worked with, and that they're generally supportive of the need to do this. I do want to tell you that the council has taken other actions to try to help. As you might imagine, we have deferred capital projects, and we are deferring more this year. We have refined the definition of reserve capacity, which isn't in statute, and I think improved it, which has lessened a bit the amount of the transfer that SAC has to make, but not solving this problem. We have tightened the SAC credit rules, which means that when there is some growth, there will be less credit. So we will be able to actually receive more money, and we won't have to raise our rate quite as much. And we do have a task force. In addition to Metro Cities, we have growing cities, central cities, cities on the edge. We have associations and some industries all represented on our task force working on this problem. There is some good news, and I wanted to just quickly tell you that our regular sewer rates for the entire Twin Cities are quite good. This rate here is from 2008 data that we report to the National Association, and includes the city's markup, if you will. This is the average retail rate. This rate makes us fifth of the 22 that we consider peers that reported, fifth lowest rates. And actually, some of the highest rate metropolitan areas don't wish to report anymore. So it actually might be even better than that. We did look at this data. We could shift as much as $17 million. We would still be fifth. We could shift $30 million before we would move. Over 17, we'd move to sixth. Over 30, we would move to seventh. So there's a lot of room for our rates in the metropolitan area to still stay low. Whoops. I also wanted to say that while water is among the most important utilities in the area, it's among the least costly. You can see here sewer and water rates are very low compared to gas, electric, cable TV, wireless, and so forth. And your wastewater utility in the metro area has been working very well. I won't spend any time on these awards, but all our plants are getting awards. We now have 36 months in a row with no discharge violations. We have about 1,000 permit requirements a year, so this is quite an accomplishment and unprecedented. We've also recently been getting awards on our efforts to reduce the energy we use, on our inflow and infiltration program. The Metro Solids project was our largest capital project recently, about $200 million, and it got a lot of awards too. Finally, if I may say, Mr. Chair, that the impact of the shift, if we had to shift as much as $20 million, which we would not expect in 1 year to have to do, it's probably about half that. divided by the number of households, we're only talking about $1.20 per household per month. So it's really not a lot of money, and as I say, we expect it to be less than that. The impact, however, if we don't do this, could be fairly dramatic. The SEC rates may need to be increased as much as 100%, as I said. We'll end up dividing by zero if development continues to go down. And finally, the council's and the Public Facilities Authority bond rating will be jeopardized by this. We do have over $1 billion of debt outstanding in the council, and we borrow much of that money from the Public Facilities Authority and pay them quite a bit of debt service. So if our bond rating goes down, the bond rating for the Public Facilities Authority that lends money across the whole state could be in jeopardy. And it was for that reason the executive director wrote a letter of support for this effort, and I hope you have that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think I could answer some questions.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the representative who held my seat from 1990 to the year 2000 might argue that maybe people in Minneapolis, through this SAC arrangement, are they in fact subsidizing development in Jordan or Shakopee? And if so, what is the the balance? How does that actually work? And would you agree with that analysis?
Representative Willett, or Mr. Willett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the promotion. Representative.
Some might call it a D motion on some days, but anyway.
SAC has actually worked in the favor of the developed cities throughout the years of its existence. There have been quite a bit of credits. Any sort of redevelopment gets credit for what's existing there. So it really has worked to the advantage of Minneapolis and St. Paul and Bloomington and the smaller central cities, and I think they recognize that. All three of those communities are on our task force and have had a say in this necessary financial shift. No one wants what really is the viability of the financial system for a wastewater system that works pretty well in jeopardy. No one wants to jeopardize that. To more directly to your point, I don't think so, but probably the benefit to the central cities might not be quite as much to the rest of the area, but they have paid more. Every time they develop on Greenfield, there are no credits at all. They pay SAC for that.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I think you're speaking of former Representative Orfield, Myron Orfield. He actually taught a class that I took where he talked about just this issue, and I kind of had the same initial reaction. However, the fact that the viability of the entire system may be in jeopardy actually would make it a lot worse if we don't pass it.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Hornstein. I support the bill for that reason, however. I do feel that the Met Council does need to do a better job of aligning its, development goals and priorities with, the way that we finance some of these infrastructure, whether it's highways or sewers, in the developing areas. Because I think, the unintended consequence might be to underwrite the infrastructure that may not align with the council stated goals, and I think that we need to do a much better job with this. I know that's separate from this issue, but in fact, it does relate, and I would just say that we need to do a much better job, and I don't think the council is quite doing that. We need to have quite a bit more attention paid to where we're investing in this infrastructure, and does it align with the broader growth and development goals.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if it would alleviate my friend's concern, perhaps he would support me in legislation to just delete the word Scott from all legislation dealing with the Met Council.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and yes, to my colleague from Minneapolis, I was on the City Council when your predecessor was out there stalking us and making all kinds of expensive decisions on our behalf or trying to, and I think there you'll find that the view from the burbs is quite a bit different than the view from Minneapolis, and I would welcome that discussion in this committee at one of these days, Mr. Chairman, when you're looking for something interesting to do and want to light up the scoreboard, we'd be here for that one.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Any other further questions of the testifier? I see we have another testifier. Why don't you please come forward and welcome to the committee and state your name for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Patricia Nauman, and I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We do represent 80 member cities across the metro area before both the legislature and Met Council. We were essentially created when the Met Council was created to try to influence what they do and be a watchdog of that body. I will say we probably weren't very excited to see this bill, probably not any more excited than the Met Council was to have to put it forward. But we do appreciate their attention to our concerns. One of the things I did want to mention is that last summer when the council was looking at doing some transferring of funds internally to deal with this problem, we did recommend to them that they create a SAC task force, which they did do. And as I see it, the work of this task force is very important going forward, so that while the council will, if this bill passes, have some authority, and we want to make sure that that authority is limited with the sunset, with appropriate triggers, and with some shifting back of funds when the SAC fund is solvent. But I think that the task force will play an important role in making sure that going forward, the policies around SAC are equitable and appropriate. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? Anybody in the audience, else in the audience, would like to speak for or against this bill? If not, Representative Stern renews his motion that House File 2949 be recommended to pass and returned to the, as amended, be returned to the Committee on State Local Government Operations. All those in favor of the bill, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Bill is passed. Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you. Next on the bill, next on the agenda is House File 3147, Representative Jackson. And Representative Stirner moves House File 3147 to be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government. And I understand you have an amendment.
Yes, I do. And thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The amendment is marked DE2, and I would appreciate someone moving that amendment to get this bill into the shape that I'd like.
Representative Stirner moves the amendment, House File 3147-DE2, to be for House, to put the bill in the shape that the chair, or not the chair, the author wants. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I understand this is a kumbaya. Peace in the Valley amendment?
It is, yeah. We were just singing in the hallway. And, it felt so good.
Would you please explain your bill, Representative Jackson? And
absolutely. You know, my district is comprised, part or whole, of four counties, and this bill was, in fact, first brought to my attention by my local county assessor and county attorney. The language that we've got before you in the amendment is also important because it's supported by the Department of Revenue. That was part of that kumbaya singing you heard out there. And they have added similar language to their policy bill. The bill and the reason for my interest in the issue is to make sure that the statutes are clear and what we say as a legislature is really meant is what we meant to say. Because every once in a while we find out that's not what we meant when some clever, enterprising attorney can run with language that was not intended. In light of some confusion and clarification requested by the tax court, we had a little more work to do, and that's what this bill is about. The three overarching issues that my witnesses will identify and comment on today include where the current law came from. In 1993, the Department of Revenue proposed language to prohibit county assessors who also hold an appraiser's license from moonlighting in their own local jurisdiction to prevent conflicts of interest. Further, the intent of the 93 legislative language was to permit assessors to perform their work in their home jurisdiction without an appraiser's license or additional regulation. And finally, it was intended that the assessor should be able to perform his or her work as well as defend their work in court. And so I think it's our job as a legislature to improve the statutory language, make the intent clear, and I think the language does just that. And, yes, over the last several days, stakeholders have been working to make sure the bill that we advance is clear, and we've achieved that. And I would like my witnesses to answer any questions. With me today are Beth Cadoon from the Department of Revenue, Steve Baker, Ramsey County Assessor, and Kathleen Haney, Sherburne County Attorney.
Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Revenue. As was stated, we also had similar language in our Department of Revenue's policy bill. The bill was then introduced separately so it could be heard in some other committees. Our bill, as originally introduced, did have some opposition from the tax section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. With this amendment, it's my understanding now that they're no longer opposed to the bill, and so that was the only opposition that we were aware of to the original language. So, as mentioned, it should be, hopefully everybody at this point, is the language is acceptable. We're strongly in support of the bill. If I could just give a brief little background regarding it. It has always been the long understanding and position of the Department of Revenue, as well as the State Board of Assessors, which does license assessors, that preparing appraisal reports and testifying in court are the normal duties of these licensed assessors. The assessor's job and responsibilities include all aspects of the assessment process, including real estate appeals. There was recent tax court cases that was mentioned that really put a stop to this long-standing practice. And the tax court, what they ruled on, really hinged on a moonlighting provision, which you'll see in Section 2 of the Delete All Amendment, which set out a prohibited practice for assessors, which was this moonlighting provision that was mentioned. This language in 1993 was put forth by the Department of Revenue. The legislative intent at that time is very clear. It really was just to prohibit moonlighting by assessors. You did not want assessors, nor do you still want them, to be able to work for their local taxing jurisdiction and then moonlight on the side doing private appraisals in that own jurisdiction. That's what the 1993 law was intended to stop. But what happened was mentioned is that was then argued at tax court on a property tax appeal this summer, that if you look at that statute, that it appeared to prohibit assessors from being able to testify in court regarding a property tax appeal in their own jurisdiction and prepare a valuation report for those property tax appeals. So what the tax court said is, well, if the language is plain on its face, we don't look any further. We don't look at legislative intent. And so they didn't. They ruled now at this point that assessors can't kind of follow that whole appeal process on a market valuation dispute, that they're prohibited from being able to testify in court, and they're prohibited then from being able to do any subsequent appraisal or valuation of a property that's being appealed. We know what the legislative intent was. I think the record's quite clear. And so we thought it very important for the legislature to be able to clarify that. Tax Court Chief Justice Perez has recently stayed a property tax appeal pending kind of the outcome of the legislature to be able to address this issue. I don't know if you'd like me to go through the amendment at this point.
Do we need to, or why don't you go ahead and explain it?
Okay, I'll briefly explain what the bill does. But just so you know what the bill doesn't do, is the tax court and courts will still have their discretion to determine if assessor's testimony should be admitted and if they should consider it expert or lay witness. That's still up to the court's discretion, which we think is correct. The court will still have the discretion on how much weight and value to give to any testimony or reports. That still remains. What the bill does, as now amended, is it clearly sets out the duties of assessors and clarifies this moonlighting provision. Section 4 really has the kind of the main language in the bill, so if you go to page 4, and that sets out what the duties of a county assessors are, which include performing appraisals of property, reviewing the original assessment, and determining the accuracy of the original assessment, and being able to testify in court and prepare appraisals for that review. Section 3 then just also references this for local assessors, if they're directed to do that by their county assessor.
Section 1 and 2 then reference the duties that were laid out in that Section 4. Section 1 amends the law requiring licensing of real estate appraisers to specify that it doesn't require the licensing of assessors, which is current law, and then clarifies the duties that were referenced. And Section 2 clarifies that moonlighting section, so it still has the prohibition on moonlighting, but we're just clarifying it doesn't prohibit them from being able to testify in court regarding appeals in their own jurisdiction. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Any questions of the testifier? Do you have further witnesses?
Yes, this is Steve Baker, Ramsey County Assessor.
Please welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Good evening. Thank you. I'm Stephen Baker. I'm the Ramsey County Assessor, and I'm also serve as an officer and on the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. I guess I would begin by saying that our association strongly supports this legislation, which would allow us to continue longstanding practices that are critical, really, to the I think to the proper performance of our assessment duties. I think the past practices, well, you know, we certainly have some difficult moments with some of our customers from time to time, really allow us to work through issues in a very calm, deliberate way that serves the citizens and the taxpayers of Minnesota very well. Not being able to perform review appraisals after we've completed our assessment really stops the work before it's finished. And I think that would be, if that's allowed to continue as a the new status quo in Minnesota, would be unfortunate. As Commissioner Cadoon testified, this change, the prohibited activity statute, came up about in 1993. I would point out that, you know, assessors have been licensed probably for about 20 years prior to that. So we have a long history of licensure. The courts have typically found the appraisals that have been prepared by assessment personnel to be credible and have given them weight in those proceedings, and we'd like to see that practice continue.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for the testifier? If not,
we have another testifier, Mr. Chair, and that's Kathleen Haney, the Sherburne County Attorney.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Kathleen Haney, Sherburne County Attorney. I also serve on the Board of Directors for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Our association is strongly in favor of this legislation, and we would ask for your consideration of that. My thought process is more the practical issues. You have to understand that when this case ruling came down from the tax court, it caught a lot of us flat-footed. At least I'll speak for myself, it caught me flat-footed. All of a sudden, I had 38 tax court cases that were ready to go into the tax court season, and the majority of those cases we handle inside our house. I mean, we use our assessors, and they do their appraisals, their review appraisals, and we sit down and we meet with folks and deal them out. What ended up happening is my tax court cases that I had on the trial calendar simply came to a screaming halt because I couldn't use my assessors, and it's not as though we budgeted for having outside appraisers come in and make all these appraisals. So I tell you what Sherburne County's experience is, but anecdotally I hear that other counties suffer from that same thing. And when you look at an appraisal that's outside, for me it can go anywhere from $3,000 up to $20,000 depending upon the type of property that we're dealing with, whether it's C&I or if it's just a home that we're dealing with. We don't have that budgeted. So from that standpoint, I would ask for your consideration.
Any questions for the testifier? Okay, thank you.
Well, just to wrap up, Mr. Chair, in addition to clarifying what clearly was intended back in 1993, with the current budget constraints, I see this bill as a great opportunity to give a little relief to the counties. Some counties, as in Sherburne, didn't budget anything and aren't in a position to even take an appeal into tax court. Others, I spoke to Ramsey, Assistant County Attorney, who handled this,
if you take it from the hiring a private appraiser from report all the way through testifying, it's averaging $25,000 to $30,000 per case. And I'd love to get that monkey off the back of the counties and allow them to use their assessors.
Thank you.
So I would appreciate the committee's support.
Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Seeing no one rushing to the microphone. Representative Sterner renews his motion that House File 3147, as amended, be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor of the bill, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, committee.
Does they have to go back?
I was trying to get you guys to pick up.
Okay. Representative Poppy. Representative Sterner moves House File 3335. Is that the order we're...
No, the second.
Be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government. Representative Poppy, proceed with your bill. And
thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here before you. The one that we're looking at first is the Maurer County office may be appointed. Thank you. With me today, I have Craig Oskerson, who's the Maurer County coordinator, and will be able to speak to this issue a little bit more. This is certainly something that's happened throughout the state. There have been right now 27 counties who have an appointed office and at least one of their positions, and this is one that comes at the right time for Maurer County to be thinking about, and they would like to have the opportunity to do that. So I'm going to ask my testifier to go ahead and talk about this bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
My name is Craig Oskerson. I'm the Maurer County coordinator. I'd like to thank the chair and the committee on behalf of the Maurer County Board of Commissioners. What I had passed out was a simple resolution that our county commissioners passed at their last meeting requesting this legislation. I'm here on their behalf to speak about that. When our board talked about it, they also talked about the need for public input. So the board has decided to go a little bit above and beyond what is normal in a bill like this, and at their next or their board meeting in 2 weeks from today or tomorrow, they're going to be holding a public input session to start getting the pulse of the public. We have an opportunity. We have an incumbent who's retiring. This incumbent has a wealth of knowledge. She's done an excellent job. She's been there 30-plus years. We have a small office. The recorder's office is a specialized technical position. So as we look at the statute, there are currently no minimum requirements when you elect a recorder. This gives the county board an opportunity to discuss this with the public and look at being able to install some requirements in the position and pick the best candidate for the position. As I said earlier, the incumbent is retiring. This provides a clean political public debate. We are not affecting a current incumbent, so it's not a controversial issue. The current incumbent has not stated opposition nor support for the bill. Her position, to paraphrase her, is that this is the debate between the county board and the public. With state funding reductions, it's going to require counties as well as cities and the state and everyone to tighten up their belt. We all know that. When you look at our county, we're a medium-sized county. We have a small county recorder's office of 2.5 people. We have a small assessor's office of 6 people. We have a small recorder or auditor's office. As we look at budget cuts, most likely all departments, including my own, will be affected. We need to be efficient. We're going to need to look at sharing and cross-training staff. So, in essence, this is also assisting in our budget reduction issues. This is a position that's been supported in the past by the Association of Minnesota Counties as their regular agenda item. We believe this meets all the tenets of transparency, efficiency, and accountability, and would request passage of the bill.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? I know
in the past, I've seen these, but we've seen these bills, and we've seen other bills to this, and there's been some objection to the idea of going from an elected position to appointed position from some of the members of the of this committee and committees that will go forward, going forward. So I know you're aware of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been aware of that, and in fact, last year, the county had asked us to consider an auditor, treasurer, recorder kind of position, and to combine that and make it appointive. And I did not, I did not carry that one forward. I know that many times we have these bills that come before us, and we make a determination, and everybody maybe sitting around the table right now has already determined how you would vote on this issue. And this is just unique in the fact that the person has put in a lot of years of service in the job, and she will be retiring. And so it comes as the right opportunity at the right time, and it is a cost savings for the county to be able to take care of this in this manner rather than bring it for the public.
Representative Kalin.
To that point, Mr. Chair, and Representative Poppe, I've traditionally resisted and voted no on these, but you know, I think we're facing a very different normal, or very different, you know, sort of new normal term that we hear passed around a lot, which I think will be banished probably soon. But I'm ready to move forward, but and support the bill. And I don't know if someone's going to offer the A1 amendment, but I'm wondering if you can or the county coordinator can speak to the savings that will be gained by having it be an appointed office rather than a elected office.
Well,
Mr. Osrick.
Thank you. Excuse me. We see in the future that we're going to be looking at a number of budget reductions and mainly personnel. And this will probably be, as we look at a future retirement coming up, will probably be a half a position that's going to be shared between a couple offices. Currently, say we're going to take a position and eliminate it, and the result will be saving a half a position between two offices, or essentially a full position. In our budget, it may not sound a lot, but as you add up little budget savings, it does become a lot to a county like us.
There's an amendment that was a reference here, the A1 amendment. Is that your amendment? Or
no, it is not.
That would
Representative
be my
Sterner.
Chair knows. This is an amendment I offered. This was a language in a bill that I was in last year that got defeated in the next committee after this one. But I'm thinking with a government redesign that we're looking at with the county government, and also looking at how it gets more pertinent with counties. We're the largest county in the state, the most populous county in the state, north and south counties, they all have at least one position that is appointed. And I'm from Dakota County, and Tom Novak, who was our treasurer over 20-some years ago, was elected, and now he's been appointed, and he's the treasurer auditor right now. He seems to be doing real fine with it and has a lot of wealth of knowledge, and Dakota County hasn't been screaming for elected the position after our recorders and auditors and treasurers went to being appointed. So I'd like to offer this as an amendment to this bill.
Representative Sterner moves the H3335 A1 amendment. Representative Poppe, what?
I would just ask that you not approve the amendment. I think that it's what we're trying to do is just be very clear that this is a Maurer County. It's regarding the recorder. It's because of her own 30-plus years of experience. She has the knowledge, skills, and abilities to do the job. They're facing some budget issues, and in the replacement of that person, they're seeking somebody who's going to be able to be appointed and be able to, again, step in with the same or a similar background and would have the knowledge, skills, and abilities to be able to do that job. And so I would oppose the amendment just because I'm not interested in taking this bill and making it for the statewide and universal aspect of it.
Anybody, any other questions on the amendment? If not, we'll move to a vote. Representative Sterner's amendment is House of our love. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion fails.
Thank
the
you.
Amendment is not adopted. Anyway, to the bill then. We're back at the original bill. Any more questions? Representative Eastland.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the issue at the county level and why they're requesting this just the efficiencies and the cost savings and the need to get qualified people in positions that take specialty. I mean, there's all of those things involved. But I guess I just fundamentally kind of have this thing about an elected position to take that away from the local community by legislative action. I think is where I kind of struggle. And I'm looking at line 2.6 on. It says the resolution may be implemented without the submission of the question to the voters of the county unless, the bar is pretty high there. 10% of the registered voters of the county have to be on a petition to stop this from happening. I guess I'm just looking at that and simply saying, I would almost be in favor of a movement like Representative Sterner just offered here if there was an approval by the voters to give this up. I guess I just find it hard that we legislatively come here and do it, then we say, well, you can undo it, and then we put a bar in there that's almost so high that we can't attain it. So, I just struggle with this whole idea we keep eroding the rights of voters. But, I totally understand where you're coming from. And I just think there needs to be a better way to do this besides just having people come and request at the legislature. I think, we're taking the right of local people in the local communities to vote away. That somehow just doesn't sit right with me, so I struggle with that, so I'll be voting against this, but it's not because I don't understand your position.
Thank you. Representative Poppy, any comment?
Thank you, Representative Eastland and Mr. Chair. Certainly I do understand that people have that position and are concerned about the right of the voters and our constituents. This really is designed to not provide for public input. We would like to have, and I would expect that the county will have public input about whether or not this is the right way for them to go. It authorizes them to be able to do that. I cut myself short earlier when I was waiting for Representative Kalin's question. I wanted to make it clear that they will not be putting this before the public for a vote, but they're certainly going to put it before the public to be able to find out if this is going to be met with much resistance or little resistance. And that's then their responsibility as a county board and a county coordinator to try to get the public to see the viewpoint that they all share to say that this is a good idea.
Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to speak for or against the bill? Any more questions? Otherwise, Representative Sterner renews his motion that House File 3335 be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Yeah, the bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm going to stay seated here because I believe the next
bill is House File 3358. And again, it's Representative Poppy.
Kind of amazing.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one is
Yeah, Representative Sterner moves the House File 3358 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, this one is a little bit different from the last one. This is actually seeking a change in the number of days that the county would be providing services to the public by going to a four-day week for county offices. And again, I have Craig Oskerson, the county coordinator. He'll be able to speak to this issue, and then there may be people here who want to speak in support and maybe in opposition to this, but I just ask you to listen and hear us out, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Oskerson.
Mr. Oskerson, please identify yourself for the tape again and proceed.
My name is Craig Oskerson. I'm a county coordinator. I'm here on behalf of Moore County Board of Commissioners. I didn't pass out that resolution. It's another resolution that shows the unanimous support of the board. This is not an initiative we just thought of this year. This was something we've studied for a couple of years. We believe the legislation that Representative Poppy has drafted meets all the interest of everyone that needs to be met. Prior legislation probably did not do that. When you look in government and you hear these words, and they're used all the time, is transparency, accountability, and efficiency, is basically what the county commissioners are looking at. And this bill is a pilot program that would allow us to look at a four-day work week, and where we believe it meets all the needs of a bill is, first of all, you'll notice on line 1.8 that the county board would have to adopt this by ordinance. That means a public hearing. We would then listen to the public and find out what their input is. Our intent of this bill is to go to a four-day work week, but to extend the office hours to become non-traditional hours to meet the needs of the public. We've had a lot of people claim they can't get to the courthouse by 4 or 5. We're talking about staying open 4 days a week till 6 at night. Point number 2, under line 1.13, and that's a very important issue, it requires an agreement by the affected labor organizations. I believe prior legislation only had meet and confer language. This requires negotiations. That's very important. We have met with the unions about a year and a half ago. We understand some of their concerns. We've also negotiated four-day work weeks with LALS, Law Enforcement Labor Services unions. We understand the issues. We also believe they're not insurmountable. We cannot go forward with a public hearing until we have that meeting with the unions and until we have an agreement with the unions. That's very important. So we believe the rights of the unions are represented by Representative Poppe's bill. And I said that's very important. We're a big labor county, and we understand the rights of unions. As I said earlier, it's a pilot project. So we have an obligation to show you, if we ever want this permanent, that this actually works and it does save some money. One of the other issues that may come up is how will this fit with the court system? Next fall, or this coming fall, we're going to be moving into a new facility. It's an energy-efficient green building. I'll get to that in a minute. And that's going to be the jail, the courts, the county attorney, and correctional services. Our remaining building is where we see the building efficiencies. We know someday the courts may need to look at it. Our current judges have expressed concern. I've met with the judges. The judges understand they can stay with their five-day schedule if they want. The county attorney's office and correctional services would simply have rotating 4 days. So it meets the needs of the courts. We're not trying to take any authority away from the judges, nor would we try. Budget savings, you heard me earlier. In our county, if, and I don't want to, at the risk of offending people, we're going to be looking, we know we're going to all be hitting local government with some reductions of county program aid, local government aid, and so forth. In our county, under the governor's budget proposal, we're looking at $1.4 million in 2011. If our county board says we simply want to transfer that to the voters, that's a 9% tax increase, let alone our normal 2 or 3%. Our board members are not interested in transferring any of that. They realize they may have to transfer some of that, and they're looking for every tool they can. When we look at our current building, we expect to have $50,000 to $75,000, probably closer to $50,000 in budget savings. When you look at reduced utility bills, we've talked to the local utility managers, and they've said if you can take 3 days in a row and have your building cool down or whatever you need to do, you have more energy savings per day than you do over a two-day weekend. I think you would find the same thing in your home. There's also going to be some building maintenance issues when it looks at custodial supplies, restroom supplies, and building cleaning. Between the two, we're going to save some money. Like I said, we're looking for a tool. When you look at these savings, you might say it's $50,000 more. County has a $30 million budget, so what? When we look at this big budget deficit that the states we're going to share in, what this translates in our county, it translates to one less deputy being laid off, or one less truck driver being laid off, or two less financial workers being laid off. We're currently pretty strapped with employees in most departments. We think pretty lean and mean. Some may tend to differ, but we think if we can save one employee out of this bill, the service of the public will be tremendous. When we talk about $1.4 million, this time in our county, we'll be looking at positions like deputies and truck drivers. We will, unless it's a tax increase, so we're going to have a tough decision. We're just asking for your support. There's some minor yet important side benefits. at the risk of reducing or offending someone. It reduces the carbon footprint for building energy costs. It doesn't affect our budget. Some people like those things. It also reduces waste that goes to landfills. We're going to reduce in our building 15 to 20% of the paper products that we use in the restrooms. So that'll reduce that waste stream. It also reduces vehicle consumption when it comes to employees only having to go to work 4 days a week instead of five. So we would like your consideration, and I would stand for any questions.
I got a question here for you first. Now, I'm reading this, and you said you're going to be extending hours. Would these people be, when you're going back to 4 days a week, would they be getting their hours cut, or would they be working four tens and still getting their 40-hour weeks in? Or are we talking about reducing hours of employees? Because that would be, if you go to a four-day work week and 4 8-hour days, that's a 20% wage cut.
Our board discussion, public discussion has been that we will keep 40-hour weeks for the employees. If we see any employee hour reductions, it'll be full employees. One of the issues our board feels is important is to be more available to the public. So we're looking at establishing office hours probably either 7 to 6 with an hour unpaid lunch, or 7:30 to 6 at night with a half hour unpaid lunch. So the employees will still have 40 hours.
Okay. The other question I have is that you talked about this being a pilot project. Did Representative Poppy, did you think about putting possibly sunset, or there is sunset lunch, expires December 15th. Okay, I missed that when I read it through. Never mind. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Rasmussen, you did mention that the bargaining units were consulted, but did they take a position vis-a-vis this bill? I mean, I know that you have the language on line 12 that you wouldn't establish the ordinance unless they agreed in writing, but what was the nature of the conversations you had with the public employee bargaining unit?
Mr. Representative Hornstein, I think there's a representative from the bargaining units here. We could ask them directly.
Okay.
Why don't you come down and...
You want to answer?
If I can answer first. About a year and 3 months ago, when a statewide bill was being proposed, we had meet and confers with all the unions, and we had mixed reactions. Of the three labor unions that we would need to meet with that this would affect, two of them expressed majority favoritism. AFSCME union has some concerns. All those concerns would need to be addressed, and that is why I believe Representative Poppy put that in the bill. Before we'd have a public hearing, we're going to need to resolve all those differences with the unions, or we believe it can't go forward to a public hearing.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
My name is Sarah Leverins. I'm the legislative coordinator for AFSCME Council 65. We represent the AFSCME employees and Maurer County. And this idea is, as the administrator explained, not new. Actually, there was a statewide bill a year ago. AFSCME and AMC were, the Association of Minnesota Counties, were not able to come to an agreement on language for that bill that, at least from our perspective, resolved all our concerns. As was explained a few moments ago, this issue was raised a number of months ago with our union there, and then basically sort of disappeared from the radar screen. And we didn't know the issue was coming to the legislature until I was scrolling through the committee schedule for this week on my BlackBerry over the weekend, and that's how we learned that this issue was surfacing before the legislature. We would have preferred, and we still do prefer, that the county work with us about how the bill should read so that this is not a weapon essentially in negotiations that can be used against us and sort of forced upon our members. The concern that we have is this is the kind of thing that hits our lowest paid members the worst. People like janitors and boiler operators who don't have to come in on that fifth day to shovel the walk or plow the parking lot
or keep the boiler running on that fifth day. Now, some of that may be resolved by the 40-hour week, but there is some of that there that is going to be part of the savings, that there will be people who will take pay cuts, and they will be the lowest paid people in the county. And it is not that this union has been unwilling to work with employers who were suffering financial problems. Our Rochester unit was faced with the decision of layoffs or of taking furloughs and agreed bargaining unit-wide to a furlough day, unpaid day, each month. Our Itasca County unit was faced with the same kind of decision and agreed to each member taking 4 unpaid days. We view that as more fair than this kind of approach, because then it goes across the bargaining unit. Everybody participates in, if necessary, the loss in pay. Instead of this, which hits the lower paid folks that you don't need then harder. And in the rural communities, those are people who go to the grocery store, who go to the hardware store, who buy gas and have their car fixed in that community. It's not just us. I mean, if public sector jobs, you know, somehow are less valuable than private sector jobs, remember that our members spend money in the private sector. They recycle that money. We would be willing to work with the county on that and with our sister union, Council 5, to see if there's a way to resolve this. But to simply discover it as we did, you know, scrolling through the county or through the committee agenda, is not a good way to work with us to do something like this.
Thank you, Ms. Leverins. To answer your question, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Yeah.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it does raise, obviously, more questions. But I think that, you know, and I'm sympathetic to the position that the county's in. And, you know, it seems like we're faced with this choice about, well, you know, either raising taxes or laying off workers. And, you know, unfortunately, that's a choice that's been hoisted on us by, you know, I think a real problematic approach to local government aid and the historic partnership that's existed between the state and local government, which is becoming, you know, frayed at this point. And I don't, my concern about this is, you know, it's a pilot project, but, you know, or I don't want to throw in the towel around, you know, advocating for, you know, fair local government aid and the partnership between the state and local governments. And I think that's unfortunately a reaction you're anticipating, that that's moving into the future, and I understand that. But boy, if we're now starting to the wholesale cut the public sector to such a degree that you know, we have to go with things like this, I think it's not a good precedent to set. I have concerns about it.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I applaud the county for trying to do something. I mean, these are terrible times that we're in, and we're going to have to be looking at many ways. I know other companies, I mean, not governmental units, but other companies are doing things like this. And since the counties are a creation of us, and somewhere in state law it says that they have to be open 5 days a week, it takes away the opportunity that you could do that on your own. So I'm just kind of curious if you're not changing the total number of hours, and maybe there might be a change with attrition. That's one thing I'd like you to address. If somebody quits, would you replace that person? But I'm wondering if it's only $50,000 that you're going to save by this, what might be a major change in your county for the delivery of your services. That doesn't seem like it's enough of a savings, $50,000. And maybe you could address that if you've really looked at figures to see if it maybe could be more than $50,000. And then regarding attrition, if somebody quits, if you would replace them.
Mr. Osterman.
Thank you.
Osterman.
When it comes to the budget savings, we don't have as large of a utility budget as you might think. We basically operate a courthouse building, and then we operate another building that we lease, and that's a human service building. We operate a highway building that we won't see much energy savings in. So the energy savings we're projecting are probably somewhere between 5 to 10% of our utility budget. We're projecting about 15 to 20% of our custodial budget. That's where we come up with the $50,000 to $75,000. When it comes to attrition, that is our preferred method if we can do that. If I could address some of the AFSCME issues, with all due respect, these issues that AFSCME brings up are not pertinent to our county in some ways. When they talk about the low-paid employees, the custodians, they do not exist in the AFSCME union in our county. They exist in another union. In our county, we also, the majority of our custodial service are done by external private sector employees. In our county, the AFSCME employees are social workers, financial workers, and clerical support. We would need to negotiate with them and look at that issue with them. As you would remind you, this is a Mower County bill. Some of the issues she may be bringing up may be pertinent to other counties. The other thing I would like to bring up, I don't know if our local membership did not watch the newspaper, watch the discussion. Not quite some time ago, the last two times we met with our legislators, Representative Poppe, Representative Brown, and Senator Sparks, we meet with them once a year before the legislative session. This was on that agenda. This was on the agenda the year before. During our meeting, to my knowledge, I think there was one union employee sitting in the meeting, so we did disclose it. We are blessed or cursed, depending on how you want to look at it. In Austin, Minnesota, we have the three major media down there. We have Channel 3, which is CBS out of Mason City. We have Channel 6, which is ABC out of Austin, and Channel 10 out of Rochester. We also have two local newspapers that report that. So it was publicized, and that was done, I would say that was at least a month before Representative Poppe put a bill in. So we did not have any local concerns raised at the time. We do realize and we understand that we need to meet with the unions to negotiate that. It's highly important we do. Did I answer your question?
I just have a question. You said the aid ones aren't represented by AFSCME, but they are they represented by other unions?
They're represented by what's called the Local 9 Courthouse Clerical and Technical Union.
Okay. Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Mr. Oscarson, I just was wondering, as we looked about having more visibility to the customer or the citizen, and I'm wondering if you looked at possible Saturday hours as well, where maybe some of the citizens would be, you know, worth maybe for the parks or being there in the mornings to be able to do things for half a day, but if you looked at maybe expanding the business week instead of shortening it 4 days.
Mr. Oscarson.
Thank you. It could be something we could look at. What we'd want to do is we'd want to be able to string 3 days in a row that we could be off. So if you looked at a Saturday, that would be one thing maybe to look at. In our county, we have no county parks. They're all city parks, though. A lot of that Saturday, Sunday stuff is not as germane to our county. Where most of our case, the customers that have raised concerns on being able to be there are the people that have traditional 8-to-5 jobs that would like an extra hour or two in the day to do their business before they go home that night.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sterner.
And I was just wondering, what is your average age of your county citizen? Just a rough idea, if you know.
Of the county public taxpayers?
Public taxpayer, yes.
I would say the average age is probably in excess of 58, 60. I think we're one of the oldest counties in the whole Midwest. I think we're one of the top four aging counties.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm thinking about this bill, I want to echo Representative Scalzi's comments that I applaud you for thinking outside the box in these unusual times that we're in. Thinking back to a meeting that I was with my colleague Representative Biskins on Friday with our own county, which is apparently a similar size, it's actually about an $80 million budget, but when you take out the federal pass-throughs, I think it's about a $36 million levy in Scott County. And they're planning already over the next 4 years to see all the local LGA go away. We're struggling right now with, I think, $1.5 million cut last year in the budget we just passed, but maybe another $2.5 million has been proposed by the governor. So As I had breakfast with the administrator again this morning, talking about these things, I know that we're in some serious times, and we're trying to get some stability and ability to look ahead. So if you're concerned about the suburbs contributing to the overall problem or just where they're at, I'm telling you that Scott County, I echo the sentiments of my colleague at the end of the table. If you'd like to just cross us out of that, just leave us alone. That's all we ask for. We can make it on our own. But that's beside the point. The point I wanted, just a suggestion, as I listened to your discussion right here with the AFSCME representative and this county administrator, in Scott County, starting 3 years ago already, when it became apparent that there were going to be cuts and that our huge increase in new building permits and new property coming on the tax roll was leveling off and indeed declining, we're now actually facing revaluations and a declining tax base in some of the commercial stuff. One of the things that happened was 7 of the 9 union bargaining units actually came to the county administrator and said, look, we got a good team here. We've got a great employee base. We don't want to eat our young. What can we do? And so they opened the budget, and they said, if we can take pay cuts of this much across the board, and I think it was 1 and 2%, or actually they've opened it 3 years in a row. 7 of the 9 bargaining units members have opened the contracts and taken pay cuts so that there, and the, with the assurance that there would be no layoffs. And in solidarity with that, the middle management, the exempt employees, took 3% pay cuts each year now for the last 3 years. I just want you to know that. That's the kind of rapport that you can build if you stay together with them. And those things can happen. Now, if the $2.5 million whack takes hold, we actually may have to break faith and let some people go, because that's a big hit to the payroll. And I don't know we can reasonably expect anybody to take that much of a pay cut to preserve that kind of a cut. But I understand the dire times you're in. So, Representative Poppy, big one to take a little risk now and then. I like the sunset concept, too, so the other 86 counties can watch and see how you do, see if the wings fall off or whether you actually make it. So I'd be prepared to vote aye on your bill and wish you well, and we'll all be watching.
And to comment to that, like I said, when I said that threw the 20% out, the city of St. Paul went to their unions and asked a year ago, and some other people made the choice to save jobs, but they went to working 4 days a week, but again, that's a 20% wage cut when you work 32 hours as opposed to 40. And my son, the same thing happened to him on his. He's a private employer, and they did that last year because of just the economy the way it was. So it's tough. I mean, so I understand that piece of it. So, Representative Biscuits.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Poppy, you know, you've got a county that's thinking outside the box, but I would have preferred you blow up the box, to be perfectly honest. I look at statute 373.052, where we actually mandate 5 days a week, and I'm wondering why. Mm-hmm. Why is the state mandating to the county? You know, the county has defined functions. Let's leave it at that. Get your work done. Do the tasks you're assigned to do, and do it in the best way you can possibly see. I wish you would have moved in to repeal that section of statute, but you didn't, and I understand. I might do it as an amendment. We'll see. But the one thing that is in this bill that I think is very concerning, members, that you have to understand. Right now in statute 373.052, there is a subdivision 1A called hours by the board. Right now, the hours of the day is strictly a managerial right. Statute doesn't say how long the offices have to be open each day of the week. It just simply says it has to be open each day of the week. Now, if you look, members, on this bill, lines 1.12 to 1.14, we are actually putting into statute an elimination of that managerial right by saying, no, you know, they can't make these changes unless the unions agree. That's putting a lot of that's a big change here. right, that we have to understand. If they go to this, to give then the unions the power to decide the hours of the day is a big change, right? It's a fundamental change, you know. If the county really wants to save money, I suppose have the county offices open from noon to 1, 5 days a week, and you now have, Mr. Chair, an 80%, well, no, much more than 80%, 88% savings at that point, all right? So I just think this bill has a little little piece in here that we have to be very, very concerned with prior to moving it forward.
Thank you. Any response? Otherwise, Representative Hilty had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Osterman, or Representative Poppe. This is represented as a five-year pilot project, and I'm wondering what you think you're going to learn in years 2, 3, 4, and 5, or years 3, 4, and 5 that you wouldn't learn in year 1 or years 1 and 2.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hilty. I think that it's just I'm not sure that there's going to be greater knowledge gained, but it was an attempt to have a period of time that it would be able to be collected. So rather than to have a very abbreviated amount of time that you maybe would have some savings or you maybe would not be able to prove that, a period of 5 years is a legitimate length of time to be able to show what kind of savings you might incur.
Representative Hilty. Follow.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, I think that this is a longer commitment than might be necessary to demonstrate anything that typically we would expect to have demonstrated by a pilot project.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Beards and Representative Biskins kind of got to the issue that I was looking at. I have a school district in my district that is looking at this option, and you know, they have a $35 million budget, and I think they're estimating to save $150,000. And you know, I mean, I served in the school board for 12 years, so I just one little statistic that is on the top of my mind that I just happen to know is 85% of the budget of any local school district, give or take a little bit, is in people. What percentage of your county budget is in people?
Mr. Oskarson.
A couple things. One thing is school districts, where they may realize greater savings is their transportation budget, by only having to bus students 4 days instead of 5 days. So I know the Adams School District, Southland, is looking at the same thing in our county. In our budget, I would say probably about 80% of our budget is people.
Yeah, and I mean, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not meaning to imply that $150,000 is much of a savings rather than $50,000. I guess the point is it's nothing. It's nothing when it amounts to the inconvenience. And you know, then we refer to the private sector. There's businesses in the private sector that do this and achieve significant savings. But the difference is that I think what Representative Beard brought up is that when you there really isn't much savings unless you really penetrate your labor costs. I mean, that's where there's going to be the largest savings. And so I think if unions are willing to negotiate, reductions in pay or freezes or those are all important pieces of, and that's kind of in here. But I think it's ludicrous to think that there's going to be anything significant that happens in terms of savings unless we penetrate the labor costs. And I think that's really an important issue. I mean, my wife works as a controller in a machine shop. They're going to 4 day weeks, and that means 32-hour work weeks for the employees. Huge savings. 20% right off the top, and so I mean, I think there's a lot of questions that I have about going. I think it's important that we talk about this, but for the little bit of savings given where we're talking about, unless we go down the road that Representative Beard talked about, I don't think there's it's really worth it. But I applaud the idea that we're looking at these kind of options, because I think these are important options that we look at. But there's some huge obstacles out there, and I don't think we should fool ourselves into thinking that we aren't going to penetrate our labor costs and come up with something significant. So, I mean, I respect the fact the AFSCME representative is here, because ultimately that's where the savings are, is in employees and employee costs. And so it will affect employees. There's just no question about that down the road. It has to, or it's not worth doing. That's just my comment.
Thank you, Representative Eastland. Any more questions? Anybody else have questions for the testifiers or the author of the bill? Anybody else in the audience would like to speak for or against the bill? Seeing no one, Representative Poppy, or excuse me, Representative Sterner renews his motion that House File 3358 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All those in favor of the bill, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I think it was a worthwhile and productive discussion, and I think my county will be considering other options. Thank you.
And with that, Representative Sterner moves the minutes from the previous meeting. All those in favor, the minutes as printed, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And with that, I think we'll be adjourned. We're going to have a meeting next week for any bills that make deadline in the Senate. And there might be a couple other ones that get heard. Otherwise, meeting's adjourned.